This is Due by Friday, a weekly challenge podcast with Merlin Mann, Alex Cox, and Max Demkin. This week's challenge, watch the first episode of The Sopranos.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm on Skype.
I'm on Skype too.
Hey. I'm trying something new. I'm making a big change right now.
Okay.
I'm just moving over to the couch. I'm sitting, mm-hmm. You know, I've done the last month of these, sitting in my computer.
Kind of the picture of someone laying on an analyst couch.
Yeah, basically.
I don't know why I'm laughing. It's not funny.
I spent the last month doing these like in front of the computer, and then I'm staring at the computer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's no good. And you guys are on the video. I like that we're not doing the video. That was a horrible idea.
Terrible.
Really cursed.
We can you know what? We're trying things. You know what I mean? We're like a couple who's been together a little bit too long. You know what I'm saying? Are you bringing some toys and do some butt stuff? You know what I'm saying? Just for fun. Happy birthday.
Like
it's your birthday.
No, I don't like it.
You don't like the butt stuff?
No. That's where the poopy comes out.
You know what? Let's go to the next topic on our list here. Hey, how's everything doing?
Oof. You know, I've decided I'm trying something new as well, and I'm just going to stop pretending that I'm okay when I'm not okay. I'm just like,
I love this. I love this.
Not good. Not good. Bad.
Do you want to talk about that? What's happening?
Nothing. The world's just bad, and it's sad.
What's paining you right now?
I mean my uterus.
I'm not being facetious. I'm just asking the question.
Honestly, the big thing is it really sucks that I don't get to see my niece who was born 9 days ago, and it.
Who's so cute?
Oh,
so cute.
God, I love her. I would already kill for her. She's in Indianapolis, which is a terrible place, and this is the first time I've ever wanted to go to Indianapolis. And
isn't that funny?
Yeah, and more than anything, it's my mom's first grandkid, and she can't see her, and it sucks. And I know that there are so many problems in the world, but it shouldn't diminish anybody else's sadnesses.
I hope we eventually. I want to say I hear everything that you're saying, and I want to acknowledge what you're saying, and I really hope that people like me and you and probably Max get to a point where we eventually stop feeling like we have to recontextualize the terribleness,
right?
By always like, no, the privilege conversation is valuable, but also at a certain point, can't we just be a little sad and have that be okay?
Yeah. I honestly, Maddie is turning 30 in a couple months, and he was really looking forward to bringing his parents to the game cafe, because as we've talked about before, my mother and father-in-law are like, yeah, let's go to Applebee's. And, you know, that's fine for a bit.
You'll get some gift cards for the game cafe. Let me tap. I think I have some right here.
We probably won't be out of business by the time you can go out back after.
It's all good news this week.
Yeah.
I'm with you though, Alex. And I applaud this. I think you're doing a healthy thing. And it's just that, and I'm not trying to say PC police or anything like that, but like, I know I feel for myself, I feel very reluctant to talk about almost anything. Whether that is the fact that I'm, as I just said on Twitter a minute ago, I'm really enjoying my 2 p.m. nap every day. Like, am I allowed to enjoy a nap? Because isn't that privilege that I get to be at home? Yes, it is. It is. But like, also, God, can't we just be cool? I'm sorry, Alex. That sucks. I was watching Bon Appetit Kitchen last night, and there's this show I just discovered on there. Probably the last person in the world. It's called One of Everything. And this dude and somebody else from Bon Appetit go to a restaurant in New York and order one of everything and take one bite. And I watched this 25-minute video of them having every item on the breakfast menu at this place in New York, and I was dying. Of all the things to sweat right now, I'm like, holy shit, I really want to stick some crusty bread into a wobbly egg right now so much.
Mm-hmm. And I also keep trying to remember that the people who are sick and dying are also like, man, I would really like to go to a McDonald's right now. And that's okay too. It's I heard a nurse on Twitter, heard, read, whatever, being like, ugh, some of these people just want to see their friends and play video games. You should be happy to be alive. And I'm like, fuck you. Just come on.
That happens a lot on, well, how does one say? If one were acquainted with someone who's on calls with people who are doctors in different locations, you would know that there is occasionally somebody who comes on these giant Zoom calls, comes in out of nowhere and says, you know, oh yeah, I hope you're enjoying your three twins ice cream. We don't have any swabs.
Yeah.
It's like,
That is such a thing though. If people go on, if you go on social media and you're like, I don't know what it is. If you're like, I'm feeling sad, or like, oh man, like it really sucks that my birthday party was, you know, I had made all these plans, my birthday party was impacted by this. Or, you know, for me, there's like business things or creative projects that I've been working on for, in some cases, like years that mm-hmm. were, you know, disrupted, canceled, whatever by this. And that sucks. Like, you don't want to work for years on something and have all these people counting on it. And then
you just sit there and watch it die on the vine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can't do it, right? It's bad. It makes me feel bad. It's all around bad. But you're totally right that if I were to post that on Twitter of like, man, it sucks that we worked for really so long on this business thing, people would be like, there's people who can't even afford food and you're thinking about a game that you worked on. And it's like, well, I don't, it's not diminishing their, like the fact that like they're immiserated is it, like to me, the right thing should be like, everyone should have the opportunity to make a game if they want. Like it's not, the idea is not that the best off people or the people that are fortunate to like do something cool or have some success, you don't want them to be like as immiserated as like right? the people who can't feed themselves.
Exactly.
The idea is that everyone should be so lucky to get to do like what Alex and I do, which is like make fun stuff that makes people happy if that's what you want. Like, I don't, it's like the politics of that are so weird to me. Like, we have the capacity for, like, nobody should have to be hungry during a pandemic or any other time.
Also, don't make jokes. Don't make jokes anymore, okay? Jokes have left the room.
We have the resources for that. And in fact, these fucking people, what about these fucking people who are going out and they're going reopen, you know, the reopen protests and they're the fucking zombie movie people banging on windows and stuff. Yeah. It's like, well, these are the same. This is the same people. Like, you just, and they're all, their message is, I need to work to feed my family. Like, if I don't go back to work, I won't be able to feed my family. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, maybe you shouldn't have spent the last 20 years dismantling the social safety net that would have made it so that you didn't have to worry about that.
Do you think these people are real?
Are they real? I mean, they're extant. Like, they're out there banging on windows of the Baskin Robbins.
But it's total astroturfing.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. I know there's some comparisons to the Tea Party and stuff, but a lot of it, I'm like, are they?
But then the media plays right into it by like showing these tight shots.
Did you see the one that I posted the other day? That was the photo from up high.
No, popping into this hell site right now.
Oh, right. Where, like, was it in Pennsylvania? Like, where they're doing these things, and then, like, folks who report on this, and I'm not trying to throw shade at reporters, but it's such a Peter Baker kind of story to, like, zoom way in on these fucking pork chop men in their red hats and, like, go, like, oh, this is a movement. And it's like, now let's go with a slightly less tight shot and see that it's not as many people as it looks like.
So someone photographed it from like the top of their apartment building or something. Like, it was the people protesting in front of some state capitol, and it was like 20 angry people in a tiny little circle. Like, it was nothing. It was insignificant. Like, I've been to like protests for crazy lefty causes that had 10 times that many people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's total astroturf. And the other thing that's crazy is like, you know, the right has this big talking point where they go, oh, all the protesters are paid by George Soros. They're all crisis actors. They're all being paid. But that's a thing, you know, it's like a lot of things. Like, the reason that they make that accusation is that's a thing that they actually do. Like,
yes,
I don't think the left, I'm not aware of anyone who's ever been paid to protest on the left, but I mean, it's widely reported that tons of, first of all, Trump's campaign announcement. Remember, he comes down the escalator and there's all mm-hmm. those people applauding in Trump Tower? Paid actors. Like, yep. There's receipts. There's like literal pay stubs for it. Like,
well, remember Hillary Clinton in a cage? That whole thing where like they had basically hired this circus of misfit toys to like do this big demonstration, and as it turned out, they were literally paid to like be Hillary Clinton in a cage or whatever. And it's like, one more thing with this economy part though that I feel like is not being well interrogated right now, which is that, you know, if you're the governor, if you're somebody like, oh God, who is it, Kemp, the guy in Georgia, who's like, and by the way, I read the same magazines you do. So there's no problems in Georgia. But even though that's where the CDC is, I'm sure it'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But the guy who's like, hey, we got to open, you got to get the tattoo parlors and the nail salons going again. And it's like, well, okay, here's the problem. Like, you know this with your cafe. If you chose to have a socially distance, like legitimately social distance safe cafe, it would be so hard to sustain. How many people could you seat in that environment and have it be 100% safe?
I feel like I probably qualified to like opine on this for a second, but like,
it's not just your cafe. It's just anywhere that's like a hole in the wall in an urban area is going to be able to seat three people at a time. It's going to be like a fucking Thomas Keller's apartment.
Yeah. Let me talk about this for a second. So the business model of everything in restaurants and most of hospitality is that basically you're sort of racing the rent, right? So the rent, you know, the rent at the end of the month, and starting day one of the month, your math is, how do I pack the most bodies in this place so that at the end of the thing I can beat the rent? Because anything you beat the rent, that's basically your profit margin, right?
That's how you make the juice.
That's how the juice gets made.
The juice must flow.
The same is true of comedy clubs, right? Like, think of like UCB just announced that they're closing their last theater in New York, and that's sad for all of their problems. Like, you know, I saw some pretty fucking great shows at UCB, but you know, the part, I have to imagine part of the reason there is they're thinking, well, even if we were to reopen next month, how could we ever get enough? Basically, they can only stay open if they fill every seat for every show. And what's the scenario where you can do that?
Everything you're describing, though, it's true of almost every business, which is, let's start from, you know, step zero is that there are a lot of people and businesses in this country that were already right on the edge and maybe a little past the edge. Let's say you went into this a month ago and you were a month behind on your rent. Well, now that is, whereas that was a problem that would pass a little bit or be not a huge problem, that's a giant problem. When you get, my understanding of, and I've been in restaurants and my family's in the restaurant business, it's like your calculation includes that weird gamble of like, in the next 6 months, I need to pack this place with three turnovers every night. And that is the way that this is sustainable in like the best. And so you're hustling, you're buying ads, you're doing everything you can to pack everybody to fill every table in that place. I feel like that's baked into the business calculation.
If I could fit eight more people in the cafe, if I had everyone stand sideways, I would do that. I think we were already past the days in this country where you could like support your family by owning a restaurant, like a Bob's Burgers. I don't quite understand how the math on that could work, because we were only open for, you know, whatever, a couple months, but with the cafe before we had to close for the coronavirus thing. But like, there's just no way. Like, it's not a failing business, but like, if we didn't also make a card game that was profitable, like there's just no way. Like, we couldn't have had the capital to start it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that good. It makes a razor thin margin, like mm-hmm. razor thin. Like, certainly, like, let's just leave aside cards and just say, like, I was the owner of this place. Like, I'd be making less than anyone in that place. I'd be making less than the dishwashers, like, less than anyone.
You'd be clearing less.
Right.
I mean, you'd be, no, in the sense that, like, so the dishwasher shows up and washes the dishes, and as long as the place is solvent, they get the same amount of money for the same amount of hours, regardless of how well the place is doing. You don't cut salaries by how, let's say it's a Monday night. Like in Florida, a lot of places close on Mondays, even in San mm-hmm. Francisco. Mondays in Florida, many, many restaurants are closed, at least in the retirement communities that I came up in. And when you when it isn't like you say, well, we're closed Monday, so, you know, or like, you know, because we're closed Monday, our profits are down 18%, and therefore I'm going to cut wages 18% this week, or whatever. Or like, we didn't have enough turnovers tonight, so everybody, I'm taking a third off.
Oh, no, I see what you're saying. Yeah, payroll's like a fixed cost. Like, you pay, you take care of your people.
Yeah. And isn't that, I mean, you say rent, but I've always heard that the salaries end up being a huge part of your nut every month.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, salary is huge, like paying your food costs. Like, we still have construction to do. Like, pay, you know, you got to, like, oh my God. It's like, well, it's like anyone who's ever owned any office or home or anything. It's just like everything's breaking all the time and you're constantly mm-hmm. paying to fix this and deal with that. And yeah, it's hospitality in general, you know, this is like, you know, everything I like in life is kind of hospitality, right? Like performance, comedy, magic, theater, food, games, like it's all sort of in the realm of service and hospitality. With a few notable outliers, nobody's getting filthy rich on this.
There's this paradox, though, to the we need to, I hate the phrase reopen the economy. That just doesn't make sense. You just can't add a verb to a noun and act like that makes sense. Okay, so let's say we reopen the economy, and Georgia's finally as the president likes to say, there's pent up demand, right? It's just gonna pass through. One day it'll just go away, right? So what do you do? You're gonna go to your nail salon. Okay, so here's the paradox. The paradox is that we are saying to people, you need to go out and get back to work because America was never made to be closed down. Get back to work and you need to be cutting hair, doing nail salon things, serving food, and doing all of this. But there are certain strictures, and first you must solve my riddle, which is this. There has to be social distancing. Okay, talk to me about how we do social distancing when you're cutting somebody's toenails. Okay, fine, whatever. We'll deal with that. Okay, so are you doing social distancing of like your operators are more than 6 feet apart from other people? Suddenly you're getting into, okay, so if this reopens and there is pent-up demand and people go, the paradox or riddle is that either it is necessarily going to be unsafe to have people in that area, and we will almost definitely see a huge return to the growth in the spread, or you're in a situation where it is safe, plus nobody wants to go because they're scared of getting a virus. Do you follow?
Well, that's the thing. Come into this, like, black pills. Come play with my black pills space right now.
Play with me!
Last night, you know, I was just popping those pills. And could this be...
You're popping black pills?
Okay, all right, moving on. Could this end up being, like, a reverse Idiocracy situation? And I'm fine. No, you know what? I'm fine to say a thing. The people sticking their heads out of cars shouting at nurses, I'm going to say that their IQ level, a little bit lower. And I know that IQ,
but
whatever.
They have those funny flags with pictures of Jews on them.
Yeah. And so let's say all of those people, economy reopens, they all go out, spend money, all get sick and die. Because honestly, yep. I'm not going to go get a haircut right away. I'm just kind of in here shaving my head. And what if all the smart people and all the folks, oh God, the problem with that is also service workers who are, you know, hospitality workers who have no choice. Their bosses are like, yep, you got to come service the Karens. And I don't want those people to be hurt in any way, but
each one of them is going to then go pass it on to two or three other people.
Yeah. And so I don't know, like, what is it going to be, a reverse Idiocracy? Like, I don't like thinking about it.
And then they say, oh, you know, the thing is, all the, who was it, McConnell's or whomever of the world are like, mm-hmm. everybody's coming along saying, oh, like, so we're going to go pay all these people to just sit at home and not work. They're going to make more money staying at home than going to work. Yes, that is what we are going to do, because if they go to work, we want to keep them on payroll, because for a variety of reasons that we don't have time to get into, it's much more costly, as you know, to hire or rehire than to keep people on. And even if you kept them on at like 75-80%, but that's the idea. The whole idea is, yes, they do stay home. Mm-hmm. They do stay mm-hmm. home. Let's keep the economy closed, because their staying home is what prevents them from getting sick. Are you getting this?
I truly don't think anybody is being paid to protest. In fact, the reason they're protesting is because their bosses aren't paying them. Like, that is, it's, I would, you know what? Come on, lefties in charge. Do you have money? I'll happily be paid to protest or whatever the fuck. No, these people are not being paid. That's why they're out there. And it's, not okay. Huh. All right, thank you for playing in the space.
You know what? You know what I find useful? There's a form of meditation in Buddhism. It's called metta, which is a kind of a loving kindness, or it's a gratitude. And I find that it's hard to be unhappy when you're helping people, and it's hard to be unhappy when you're expressing gratitude. So I wanted to talk about the first responders, Max. Have you had a chance to see the image that I sent to her?
Oh, God. All right, let's start the show.
So what I'm looking at here, who wants to describe this? It looks sort of like a painting by the great... George Tooker from the 50s.
Is it in a different, how do you?
I put it in the Dream Team.
Marilyn, let me ask you this.
Yes,
when you send a text, how do you decide which
channel
to put it in? There's so many channels. Why would you have so many?
That's a really good question. I should probably pare this down, or at least get some better names and icons. Mm. I just always try to think, like, who's going to love me more if I put this here? You know, and sometimes I need that. I need Jen to like me a little bit, or pretend to like me, which is very close enough for me.
Please describe. God, this is just a nightmare.
This is really this. I saw this. I woke up this morning. I get out of bed. I'm micturated, and then I said, "I've never maybe seen anything that's quite so much Max's shit as this."
That's
image.
Really so good.
So it's so. What are we looking at here? We're looking at a hallway at what appears to be a hospital, and with some really strong perspective.
It may be a mental hospital.
Save it for the show. Oh my God.
Oh boy.
This image should be passed far and wide. Mm-hmm. It will be in show notes for this episode. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at here is...
Oh, buddy, it's the show. It's the motherfucking show art.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I can't
So there's a woman who I don't know where this came from, but it's posted on a woman's Spanish language account with some emoji and the word gracias. And it's a picture of what I'm going to say are three medical professionals walking down a hallway, probably a doctor, nurse, you know, whatever. And they're walking around, they're wearing masks. And on either side of the hallway is a pantheon of heroes from the world of DC and Marvel. And they're all bowing as the medical professionals walk down the hallway, including Deadpool. Because you know Deadpool loves him, a medical professional.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's and what happens when the Hulk stands up? I guess his head goes through the ceiling?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Hulk not like low ceiling of medical facility.
That's so funny. The Hulk is sort of stooped over in a bow, but yeah, that's as high as he can actually stand up.
The question many, many people are asking, though, on the DC side, why is Dr. Manhattan there? Dr. Manhattan and his hog. He's covered by Wonder Woman's head is covering his hog, I think, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Alex points out that somebody's trying really hard not to look at his dong.
He seems to be making eye contact with with one of the male nurses. And the only reason I say nurse...
You know you check out that penis.
100%.
You know you would be scoping the penis.
Absolutely. But I can't help but notice, this is the one guy without goggles. What the fuck? Like, why?
If there's a 7'8" huge glowing blue man and he's nude and his huge hog is hanging down to the floor. It's conspicuous. First of all, none of these people, am I to believe, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Am I to believe that each one of these people has a different backstory, mm-hmm. right? You've got Superman, right? He's an alien. He's powered by the sun. You've got Spider-Man. He was bitten by the spider. You've got Thor. He's just a god who travels, I guess. And then you've got, you know,
a
fucking
god who travels.
And then you've got Batman. And Batman's just a regular guy with like gadgets.
He's just a rich sadist. Yeah.
Each one of them has a different set of powers, and I do not believe that they all have like a super immune system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mm. And yet they're all just, you know, shoulder to shoulder here.
Yes.
and none of them have a mask.
You're right. They're not being safe. They're not really respecting the troops. I call them warriors.
Do you know how hurt I'd have to be right now to go into a hospital? I'm not going into a hospital. And if I did, I'd have like gloves and masks and I'd be all suited up. And Batman, he's just got his mouth right there.
Yeah. There's going to be lots of droplets. And also, I mean, like, if I were, God forbid, if I were in this mental institution and intubated and I walked out and the Hulk was out in the hallway, I think I would, I don't know if I'd feel safe.
you would either feel unsafe or just be like, I am in here for the right reasons. Look at seeing all of this. And that's normal. Everything's fine.
Oh, you're saying wait a minute. You took it and you turned it. What you're saying is that maybe we could improve the state of many people who've been briefly institutionalized. Maybe somebody could speak to this. How would you feel if you had been put into an institution and you walked out in the hallway and the pantheon of superhero villains were bowing in the hallway?
Mm-hmm. I'd be like, it's moved into my brainstem.
I'm here for a reason.
Yeah.
No wonder they took my bathrobe away. You think Epstein's in here somewhere? No, that'll all be in show notes. Deadpool, man. Deadpool's so reverent.
It's not very well drawn either, and there's some sort of weird optical illusion where the more I look at it, the more it looks like, for example, doesn't it sort of look like Batman's head is on Wonder Woman's legs?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hot.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that painting I just sent you. I did one of my long essays in 20th century painting class on this painting I love called The Subway by George Tooker. The museum's closed today. That sucks. Sorry, Whitney. But look at that photo. Doesn't that kind of remind you a little bit of what we're looking at? It's in the channel. Does that remind you a little bit of what we're looking at here with the superheroes?
Oh, boy. This is very, it's really, this is giving me a bad feeling. I don't like looking at this.
Uh-huh. That's supposed to. Look, all those angles and stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You should read my paper about it. It's really quite good.
And the facial expressions.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think the first thing is you got a sort of a prison. Definitely. That's what just
to me, it screams Kafka in some ways. Where like, look at the. There's one guy who appears to be like crying down the hallway, and then another guy who's like in this little. Is that a phone booth? What is he in? Like, this painting is just. And then James Dean's in there for some reason. It looks like.
If you look off to the left down the corridor that sort of goes out of frame to the left, it looks more and more like a prison to me.
Yep. Totally. But that, for some reason, as soon as that popped up, yes. Number one, I thought I've never seen anything more Max's shit. But then it also reminded me of this very depressing. Anxiety-producing painting.
Ooh. Yeah.
So thanks to everybody who's in the hallways at the hospitals.
What's the perspective is really upsetting, too.
Yes.
It's got sort of an Escher, mm-hmm. I don't know, something I don't like about it.
I feel like this is breaking your brain so much that you can't even critique the lunacy of the situation, and you're just critiquing like how how it's
drawn. the technical components.
I mean, mm-hmm. the wrinkles in these scrubs too. That's not how scrubs look.
Alex, I'm looking at the Subway.
The Subway by George Tooker, 1950. Did you get that?
I like this painting.
Isn't it a good painting? You should get that for your game cafe.
I like that.
And like those, it does look like a New York subway station. It's got those those very upsetting turnstiles.
Oh, I see where we're at. Oh, no.
Damn. I just thought of another thing that's not going to survive this.
That's fun.
Escape rooms. Those are fucking done.
Tony Sindelar says you can get escape room supplies delivered to your house if you want to escape your house. I'll try and find the tweet.
That's a fun job. There is like escape room in a box. Like I've always kind of wanted to make one of those. But
I know. It's serious.
Okay, I'll do it. It sounds kind of fun, but I wouldn't
escape
mind.
Escape room in a box. Yeah.
Oh, fuck. I loved escape rooms. God damn it. They're all going to go out of business. The other thing that I'm worried about, I think our whole society was already on this trajectory of like crazy, you know, consolidation. So like this like grouping, right? Of like you had like a very small number of like super elite people on the top, and then the vast majority of people on the bottom who sort of had no mobility, no chance of escape. It's sort of this like permanent underclass, and really all they could do is sort of do like drive Uber and do like gig work and things like that.
Multiple gig works.
Yeah, you're just there's always some fucking carrot dangling in front of you that you have to chase, but it's never like a job with any commitment from an employer, you know, that kind of a, like the type of job of like, I think that's kind of already on its way. You know, a middle class job is kind of already, I think, on its way out. But anyhow, I really worry that what's going to happen on like the macro level over the next couple of years is like any sort of like, so like look at what happened with like restaurants, right? You guys have seen the story that like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse.
Yeah, and something called Potbelly Sandwiches.
Potbelly is actually a wonderful.
Well, the point being that there are giant mega corporations that are taking SBA loans, and it's pretty lame.
Correct, and they're, so what's happening is they're taking the SBA loans, which they probably shouldn't be doing,
because they, as people said, including that the man with the terrifying mouth, Mr. Mnuchin, is saying, you know, the thing is they do have, it's true, they have other means of capitalization that are not available to businesses that are failing in real time.
Correct. So, so what they did is they all have like these, they're, I don't know, they have some lawyers who made the subsidiary companies that are technically small enough on paper to apply for the loans.
Well, they all had relationships with their banks, so they were able to walk right to the front of the line in a way that people who don't.
Yes, that's the other thing, is that the federal government just sort of said to the banks, oh, you guys figure out how to go ahead and implement this, and the banks obviously favored the customers that are profitable for them. So anyway, you have a couple of restaurant groups like Ruth's Chris and maybe I didn't hear about Potbelly, but that sounds plausible. And they're soaking up just tons and tons of money. Meanwhile, like Cafe put in for a loan, we haven't heard back. Like, I don't know. I talk to chef owners all the time. I haven't even heard of anyone getting money for their like chef owned restaurant, because it's not a, because we're not a big client for the bank. Like, the bank doesn't really give a shit about us as compared to like Potbelly, which has in Chicago has, you know, dozens and dozens of locations. But, anyway, I think what's going to happen is all the people that PPP money is supposed to be going to, you know, the independent businesses, your neighborhood coffee shop that's not a chain, stuff's all going to go under on a long enough timeline, because even if they're able to reopen, the customers will not come back in force, you know.
The polling shows that this is widely supported by a broad bipartisan, multipartisan swath. It's like, we're not ready to go back yet. Like 50-60% more of people.
Listen, like, on the one hand, to use a cafe as an example, I would love if we could open tomorrow and it was packed, like before the pandemic, like every seat full. Like, that would be awesome for the books, for the business, for me making payroll, like the business surviving. Like, I would love for that to happen, like abstractly. Then I think of myself, like, would I want to go in and work? Let alone, would I want to go to a restaurant that was that crowded and eat?
Nope.
Right, totally.
And the answer is no, I would not. Not next week, or maybe even in a month. I don't know. Like, it could be a long time for me personally before I feel comfortable going in that like packed environment, right? Like, imagine like going through the airport, going on an airplane, like being, you know, waiting in the customs line. Like, it's weird. It's unsettling. I don't want to, you know, it's scary. I don't.
Yeah, there was a thing on local public radio news yesterday. And right now there are so many moments of like insane, mixed message stuff. So like the San Francisco airport has been doing all this construction. They like are doing this new Harvey Milk terminal. I think where Terminal 1 is, but in any case, they in rapid succession threw out the fact that like, yeah, they're going to partially open part of this new terminal. They're going to move, I think, United over there for some of this stuff. And then they threw out this number that the number of flights in San Francisco is down something like over 90%. And really, I just thought about that for a second, like down over 90%. So like the people working at the rent-a-DVD place, the people working at the, you know, at all the coffee places, at the places where you buy those dumb neck pillows, like all that. And like, that's massive. And yet at the same time, they're still like, oh yeah, we're still moving some things around, doing some construction. It's like, what do you think? What am I to make of that?
Disney, I mean, we've talked about, we remember we read that Married to the Mouse book, like Disney World in Florida, just one company, one branch of one company, one project of one company, right? I think they employ like 250,000 people at Disney World.
Oh,
like
a lot. Yeah.
Like, how long before you'd go to Disney, like personally, how long before you'd go to Disney World? A while for me, I think.
Maybe November at the earliest.
We were still hanging on. We had our trip scheduled for the last week of March for spring break. And even in the first week of March, we were still like, oh, you never know. Could be real empty. We could just really take the place over, you know? But like that's the before times.
I mean, Iger came back to Disney. Like, he came back. How do you... Mm-hmm. He is a bajillion millionaire.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. There was the press... He did a press conference, and someone was like, are you coming back just to, like, positively affect the stock price? And he was like, no, next question.
Yep. He's like, right. No, I'm it's fine.
And then he takes the hand of the other, the current guy who's supposed to be there. He keeps slapping him in the face with his own hand, saying, why are you hitting yourself? I'm the Bob now.
Anyway, let me finish my depressing thought from a minute ago. So I think all the businesses that are like a normal business started by a person. So like the neighborhood restaurant, the corner coffee shop, all that kind of stuff. Hard for me to see a scenario where they make it given the current trajectory, but maybe I'm being too pessimistic, but a lot of that stuff is going to go away. And then what you're going to have is as this stuff is, the real estate becomes available, the value of labor gets lower and lower, you're going to have people with money, the capitalists who own capital, it's going to be a fucking field day. They're going to buy everything. You're going to have massive consolidation.
Amazon's just going to buy out cities.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, to think of like coffee shops, right? Like every coffee shop is going to, if they cannot reopen and get back up to scale in some reasonable amount of time, like all those coffee shops are going to fail. People still need coffee. So someone with capital will move in and start. Maybe it's Starbucks. Maybe Starbucks will buy all these coffee shops. Maybe it'll be some new thing we haven't thought of yet. I don't know. But like the whole, like, we all, I don't know. Like, to me, like, that's the cool part of being in a city, is that I like that there's all these little, you know, things out there. And it's just like all the joy of being in this, all the joy of all this shit that I love, right? That's what I love being in the city, is like theater and like weird little restaurants and all that kind of stuff. And like, I'm just feeling so pessimistic that shit's going to survive.
Well, and somebody told me once, I have no way of saying whether or not this is true, but you know, we're talking about businesses that aren't what they seem, and what, not just mattress stores, but somebody was saying that basically that, at least in the 90s, was it Walgreens or Eckerd's? It might've been Eckerd's. They said it's really less of a drugstore chain than a real estate holding company. That part of the strategy for some of these companies like that was to buy, you know, the way you'd have a Boston Market at the in the parking lot of the shopping center. They would own that piece of real estate or have a crazy long lease on that. And that one thing Walgreens or one of these stores had going for it was that they owned a ton. They were corporate, not franchise, obviously, but they're corporate owned, and that they owned the real estate under which the store was located. Now imagine these like hedge fund dickheads coming in and being able to clean up. So just to pivot on what you're saying, Max, being able to come in with just redonkulous amounts of money for somebody who really needs it, whether that's buying out a lease or buying out that real estate, they're just going to be cleaning up. And if I were Amazon, I don't think it's Starbucks that should buy those coffee shops. It's probably Amazon. Because then think of all the shit that they could do the same way that they put all the Amazon Lady in a Tubes in the Whole Foods. Like, it's just, it is really wild to think about how we survive this in a way that doesn't just make Omni Megacorp everywhere.
Do you know a really good example, example of how this is going to feel is like over the last decade, as like all this different media failed, right? Like, think of like local news failed and local newspapers failed and then major newspapers and national news sources failed. And basically it was all bought up by private equity firms, and they turned everything into a website that posts
like people who ruined The Ringer, like those kinds of people.
But it's like everything just turns into like they post like disgusting recipes that they're farming clicks by just trying to make people mad at, and then they post like celebrity gossip and things you're supposed to get angry at. It's all becomes like this like indistinguishable paste, and then you have only like two media companies, right? Like, you have like that you can get the fucking news from, and you know, it's the fucking whatever, the Washington Post and the New York Times, and you pick your mediocre news source. Like, it all sucks. And oh, and not to mention, I mean, obviously, like, what happened to local news is even more disgusting with what's that company that bought all the local news stations and makes them
Sinclair.
Say the same?
Oh, I didn't know about
this. Yeah, right, Sinclair.
Gross.
Yeah, so like every local news station got bought out by this very conservative media company.
It's like if MyPillow was a media company.
Yes, and they basically make local, and so local news is still local TV news is still like widely consumed by a ton of Americans, and also one of the most trusted trusted news sources, and they make them say these conservative...
Well, they definitely have a high level of engagement. It's free on broadcast TV, so you can watch it in your nursing home or your apartment or while you're waiting for your hot dog, and it's how a ton of people get their news every day.
But it also has, like, a higher relation to your life than CNN, right? Like, because mm-hmm. it's like, here's the crime that happened in your neighborhood, in your city.
Oh.
Here's the weather for you. You know, it's trustworthy. It's, like, it's right there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's local. It's close. And they make them repeat the same talking points and carry these, like, very, like, fucking Trumpian commentators. And you can actually see, if you go online and look at, like, local news compilations, like, you can see these.
Yeah, there's some supercuts of these, and they're really gross.
Yep, they're very, it's very fucking, like, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, because you have, like, 60 different media markets, and they're all saying the same thing over and over and over, the same talking points. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that they're driving this, like, reopen the country bullshit right now. I mean, I don't watch local news, but anyway, that feeling of, like, the fucking body snatchers came and ruined the news, and now you can only get this disgusting slop, and even the slop that's your brand is not good anymore. That's what's going to happen to everything. That's going to be food. Ugh. It's going to be entertainment.
I'm trying.
Where should we flee to? Where should we flee to? Should we go? What about France? France seems like it might be cool.
I could enjoy France.
Yeah.
Do you think we'd have to speak French?
Yes. They're grumpy people, I'm told.
I heard they like it if you try.
Oh yes, I'm.
I don't know that I have it in me to relearn how to do all of my magic tricks in French.
Allons-y. Challenge! The challenge this week comes from, I want to say, Max.
It was a Max challenge, but it was in consultation with a friend of the show, Matt. We talked about it together. We were talking about The Sopranos. And Matt said, you should make this a challenge. And I was like, you know what? It would be a good challenge.
Yeah. So we did it. I did it.
Oh, shit. Alex, you were the one who hasn't seen The Sopranos, right?
Correct. And I watched the entire first season.
Whoa. Oh, shit.
Whoa. Yeah. Whoa. No, wait. I'm doing it wrong.
Oh.
Oh.
Oh, it's the best. It's one of the best. Dad, hey, Dad, pass me the fucking mashed potatoes. Oh!
Hey, did you hear what I said to him? I said, your mother was over here sucking my cock. Did you hear that? I missed Polly Walnuts. So we did it. It sounds like we all did. I watched it with my kid. Made her watch it.
Wow.
Really? Was she engaged?
Yes. She super loved it.
How old is... Remind me how old she is.
12. But we got into, I want to say, the second episode, and I was like, we should probably dip. I don't want to do too many of these. I tried to pivot hard to if you like this, let's watch The Godfather. That was kind of a hard sell. But no, I rewatched it, and I still think it's, I have so much to say about this show.
I believe this when The Sopranos was on, I was probably about 12. And I remember, like, my dad would watch it, and I would see it sometimes. And I remember it was pretty frightening to me at 12. I mean, it was very, it's not that the violence is scary.
It's menacing. The show's menacing.
The show is so, it's so nihilistic. And yeah, it's a very, yeah, right. It's a,
cause think about that scene in Goodfellas again with Christopher Maloney, in a much earlier time, but where he's shooting that spider. Cause he's not, you know, you step and fetch it. And you're shooting at him. Like, it's that kind of thing where you're like, this could all go real bad at any time. There's so many things on this show that are, you know, I hope we'll really...
But it's also it just has a mood, right? Mm-hmm. The whole show is... It's not even the content, the gangster stuff.
The setup of the first episode, I'd forgotten how well this is done. I think I might have even said this last week, where Tony becomes like the Giving Tree. Where, like, however you feel about Tony Soprano, the one thing you can say in that episode is that he feels besieged on all sides by change, by disloyalty, and by all the different ducks of his life flying away. That's why that moment is so powerful, because it's not, it is about family, but you know what else is family? Family is family, and your family, your Cosa Nostra is family. It's all about family, capital F and lowercase f.
The opening, you know, scene is he's in Dr. Melfi's office for his first appointment. He comes in, he sits down, and it's very slow, and it's punctuated by these long silences, and she's
his
like
breathing, his exhaling should be second on the call sheet. My God,
yeah, and it's just like it's like there's like the Alex, what's that called where it's the shot back and forth with the two faces. Like over the shoulder, like what is that?
A 180? 180 rule?
Sorry, Todd.
I can't remember that shot, but it's him looking at the art, and it's just like very slow, and she's like, tell me about the time you had the first attack. And then that like techno music starts, and he's walking down the driveway, and he's like, you know, I feel like I came in at the end of this thing, and it's like they're telling you what the whole show is going to be about. Like, it was so
the whole show is that this is, and so many of the great mob things we've seen over time is about that change. Where you think about in The Godfather, or I guess it was Godfather 2, where they're talking about, you know, well, you know, oh no, actually it was in Godfather 1, they're talking about why we don't do these certain kinds of organized crime. And that continues then into Godfather 2, where they're saying, you know, oh, we'll do drugs, but we'll keep with the colored people and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There was an ethic, and you don't rat out your friends and all of those things. And at the same time, his kids are flying away like little ducks in the same way. You know, Uncle Junior is a kind of duck flying away. All of his guys, like Christopher, trying to like make a little money on the side with the coke. There's all these things that he's got to deal with now.
Yeah, and then the end of that little sequence where he has his little opening monologue, and that's like the whole thesis statement for the show, based for the whole whatever 7 seasons of the show. And then he picks up the newspaper and starts walking back up to the house. Then it's this very abrupt, like off beat in the music, like cuts back to the office with Dr. Melfi, and they continue the conversation. And there's just still probably never, it's just so bracing, and it's so cool, and it's fucking great
and smart.
It's so good.
It trusts the viewer, and I have a lot to say about this, about how this really should be regarded as kind of the beginning of the Platinum Age TV. I'm not the first person to say that, obviously, but it's so smart and so complex.
For all the good shows and all the crazy filmmaking and all the stuff that's been done, like that first 5 minutes of Sopranos just hits so hard. It's perfect. It's like the best writing, the best acting, and then it hasn't aged like in a way that like a lot of like, if you know, I don't know, like
Sex in the City seems pretty dated now compared to something like Sopranos.
It's just like, yes, it's just, it still feels so fresh and bracing. Anyway, Alex, I'm dying to get
Alex, talk.
Impressions.
Watching this felt like it was a show about the late 90s or early aughts that was made today. Like, I've always heard, such a classic, and this is what started the golden age of television, which is all true, but wow, it was remarkable. And the filmmaking as well as the storytelling, I'm just repeating everything that you guys are saying, but I was led to believe that Tony Soprano was a very complex character in terms of like, is he good or evil? And he is, you know, one of the first antagonists that, you know, you're rooting for him because he's really, you know, the main character. Mm-hmm. Like,
he is kind of a classic anti-hero in some ways.
I don't think so. I think he's a really I don't want to say he's a good guy.
Oh, like you said antagonist. You mean protagonist? Do you think he's the?
I think he's a person that is. There is such a decency to him that reminds mm-hmm. me of the Godfather. What's his name? Vito. What's the
Marlon Brando? Vito Corleone.
Yes, Vito. I don't know. Like all of the complicated decisions he has to make are very Godfather-esque, or Godfather 1, really, of like, this is business, and I am conflicted when it is, you know, I've got to whack somebody who is very close to me and is part of my family. Just in the same way, he's got to make a tough decision about, do I put my kid on ADD medication? And, mm-hmm. you know, he has the same side effects of Prozac and lithium than as normal people. And I don't know. I wasn't having these huge qualms about, like, is this guy a good person, or is he? He seems like a very nice human being, and at the heart of the root, like you get deep down of and this is later on in the season, but is he? You know, what's the nature of good and evil and stuff like that? But the, you know, the show being about the dichotomy of these two families, his and the family. I don't know. I love this guy. He doesn't feel like a Walter White. He, mm-hmm. you know, that he feels like a fairly selfless person.
He's very vulnerable.
Yeah.
For sure.
I mean, sure. Like, you mm-hmm. know, he's fucking his girlfriend on the side. And I would say that that's not, you know, more or less evil than a lot of, if you want to call it evil or indecency, than a lot of just men today who are kind of shitty. And I don't know. It's like someone's born into this life, and you know, there's a certain type of privilege, but in the background, it's always looming of, oh yeah. I think one of what's his name? Hesh at some point is talking to a black guy. He's like, we were being killed by white people way before you were. And I learned a lot of new Italian slurs, as well as slurs for Polish people that I did not know were slurs, just because I heard them all growing up.
Oh, good
up.
For you!
Yeah,
you can use those.
I can't. I didn't mm-hmm. know Polak was bad. That's just something that
what?
Yeah. And I'm wow. like, really? But I don't know, this whole, maybe he devolves through in later seasons. I don't know. The only reason I only watched the first season was because of time.
They definitely push your boundaries as it goes. And also, I don't think it's like a huge spoiler, but like the James Gandolfini also and David Chase, who is the show creator, they sort of wanted to see how far they could push Tony because you have to understand, like, in the, I also want to come back to the idea of your what you were saying about a 90s period piece. I'm really interested in that. But basically, like, this had never sort of been done before on like a big scale like this on TV, and I think they were sort of interested. Tony Soprano became this sort of cultural icon, mm-hmm. and you know, I think he sort of was very influential of like American men, and I think there was like a big cigar smoking trend at the time that maybe was associated with the Sopranos.
But it's also got a little bit of that Fight Club quality. It's got a little of that Fight Club quality where you're like, oh God, who was it? Oh, I was listening to that wonderful Blank Check podcast, and one of the hosts was talking about why he loves RoboCop so much, and he said something, this is one of those movies where like it's going to be fun for the dumbest person in the room, and it's going to be fun for the smartest person in the room.
Oh, that's so good.
Something you could also say about Fight Club, a movie that I have certainly heavily misunderstood in terms of intention. Ditto here. It's like you're going to get out of this what you choose to get out of this about ethics, and
I think it's drove James from what I've read about the Sopranos, David Chase and James Gandolfini, it kind of drove them crazy, the cultural reception to Tony and the sort of maybe popular understanding of him as like a cool guy that like men wanted to be more like or whatever.
Yeah.
And so as time went on, he put on a ton of weight, and
he looks virtually slender in this first episode.
Yeah. He becomes just more like mean and slow and fat as it goes on.
Well, he eventually looks like Kingpin. He's just huge, and his breathing is so like labored, and you're like, oh my God, how is this guy still?
Well, and that's what I kept thinking of. Is this, you know, the burden of am I good or evil, or is this the burden of just everyday American? I mean, they're like upper middle class. They're not, you know, millionaires. That to me
is a big theme of the show that aged just so fucking well, it's a thing that is interesting about organized crime, about, you know, grifting and racketeering and cons and things like that, which is like that is sort of the foundation of like huge parts of our economy and our politics right now.
Right. And
like everything is fucking grift and racketeering.
And they have that conversation. It was a bit on the nose, but at this is getting into much later on in the season, but you know, there's that very waspy conversation of, you know, how is this different than Wall Street? And it's like, yeah, exactly.
But like the smallness of the grift of like, oh, you know, there's these DVD players. Of course, everybody gets a DVD player that fell off the back of a truck. It's like, is it as good as a laser disc, you know, and all that stuff. And it's just, there's that. Like when we talk about the smallness of the grift, I mean, like that's such a common element in so many of these movies is that all the capos, like whenever there's a haul like that, the capos all get some little piece of it, whether that's a fur coat or a DVD player. And it's just all so tacky. But real, like so real. Mm-hmm.
I don't think what I'm saying is not quite like, oh, it's like, what's the difference between organized crime and Wall Street? Although you could certainly, there's that case being made. But I mean more like fundamentally, like there's like huge companies like Facebook. And to me, their entire business model is fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
Like at its core, it's fraudulent. And history will look back at this moment of like these like mega corporations that were worth a ton of money. And they'll be like, I just don't understand how no one saw through it, how they kept this illusion going for so long. And that's the ones that are reputable. But then you could talk about something like Theranos, right? Which was, I mean, fucking former Secretary of Defense was on their board and all these reputable people, and they kept this outrageous scam going.
Yeah, it wasn't in spite of those influential people that they were seeing well. It was like because of them. Because each one of them needed to get their nut back out of what they'd invested, and it was never a good day for them to stop smoking crack.
Yes.
Like it was never a good day for them to go, yeah, I'm not so sure about this one drop thing. That does seem a little far fetched. And it just, the grift goes on until it doesn't, you know?
Theranos, Enron, I mean, I'm just, these are the ones off the top of my head, but then you get into the whole, like, I'm sure you guys have read the same, magazines I have, about the whole Trump organization and the way that it's a kind of a money laundering organization where essentially they license out their name and they get involved in these crazy sort of
It's a place where Russians can spend money.
So,
can, like, put their money.
And the whole nature of like we were talking about before, like the conservative media, the media and ecosystem at large has a way of taking these like insane stories and then like laundering them through greater and greater layers of responsibility until you have to hear about it on NPR, or, you know, the New York Times or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't mean to say, I mean, my message, like the thing that The Sopranos makes me think of is not like, oh, it's all corrupt, like Wall Street and that. That's not quite what I mean. I mean like,
well, like I said, it was a bit on the nose.
Yeah, but I mean like literal scamming, like scams. Like, yeah. Like I know that I'm lying and I'm going to do it to people as a scam. Is it an all-time, like, that has become a prominent feature of everyday American life. Like, MLMs. Look at all the people get involved in MLMs.
Yeah. Young Living, any of that stuff, yeah.
Like, it's such a feature.
I mean, just data mining and, you know, we're constantly being, I'm sorry, I'm just repeating what you said, but people are not only going to look back and be like, how did Facebook get away with this, but also, how did we just sign over our lives and be like, oh, yep.
Even leaving aside the privacy thing, the bigger scam of Facebook is that their shit doesn't work. Like, their ads don't convert. They don't make money for anyone. There's no value being created. They're not providing anything of value. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No one, like, the only people spending money are advertisers just throwing cash into a black hole.
You got to just keep churning the grift and, like, turning it over like compost. And it's like, yeah.
And it's all fueled by VC, and like you said, Merlin, like with the VC, it's like there's never a good day for anyone to stop smoking crack, right? Like no one's going to be like, wait a minute, this is all fraudulent. But there is a certain, I think if you live your life in that way, there's a certain way that you look at the world and you look at other people as marks and suckers. I think there's a certain way that you regard, you know, other people and your relationship to them. And there's a I don't know what it is, this foreboding or anxiety, that is a feature of American life that everyone is very familiar with. And the idea that The Sopranos was made, you know, whatever, I don't know what, 20 years ago, wild, because it's about that, and that it's just everything. All the themes of that show have just gotten, in my mind, bigger and more prominent, to the point where we have fucking Donald Trump, who's one of the later season characters, you know, one of the villains of the season from The Sopranos. Ooh. These fucking oatmeal brained, you know, aging mobsters who are can't too dumb to sort of follow the code, but everyone they achieve some sort of status, and then Tony has to contend with them. That's Trump to a T.
Yeah, to paraphrase Annie Leibovitz, was it Annie Leibovitz? No, it was, what's her name? The lady in New York, Fran Leibovitz. She said something, you know, she had that line about how Donald Rich is the poor man's idea of a rich man.
Yeah.
But he's also how the, like, middling successful grifter, their idea of a successful grifter, like, for sure. Can I mention one thing mechanical about the show that I do think about?
Yeah.
Okay? Can I pivot to that?
Yeah, I had one last thought about that, which is part of Trump's grift is, like, by having the illusion of wealth, by creating this sort of brand of wealth where he, like, lives in a gold apartment and, you know, has Trump steaks, and he just, it's what is that? That it's like this, he's like cultivating this brand of sort of dumb luxury and opulence around him at all times.
Yeah, he's basically a licensee. He licenses his name to things. That's what he does.
But it's this constant. He always has to be seen in a certain way, and it's that mm-hmm. reinforces that what that is doing is sending the message of, oh, if what I was doing was fraud or ineffectual, I wouldn't live in a golden house.
Oh, I see. It's like a self, it's like self-fulfilling prophecy. But, like, you can see, like a priori, I am successful because I am successful.
Correct. Mm-hmm. It's this, like, well, you can't, how do you argue with this? I live in a golden house, right? And I have more money than you.
I shit on a gold toilet for some reason.
And isn't that another huge idea explored with The Sopranos, which is the idea of buying legitimacy, and that it's never enough, and how it affects everyone in your life, right? The Carmella, Tony relationship, right? Like, to me, like, I just, that's gotta be kind of what it's like to be in Trump's family.
Mm-hmm.
And his fucking awful fail sons
oh.
are just like AJ.
Oh. Well, here's something that I kept thinking about, though, like the Trump family and everything, it's all an illusion. But what the Sopranos and all of, you know, whatever the big mob family is doing, like it's all fairly transparent, though. Everyone knows what is happening to them. Like the unions know that, yep, we are being stolen from because of this thing. Everything, while it is almost above board in like a somewhat literal sense of, like, yeah, we know what's happening.
But it's a system in which you must participate.
Yeah, and it sucks.
You don't get to opt out of this system. You pay off people because that benefits you. There's this whole, like, circle of life thing going on where we're like, yeah, of course it's a grift, but, like, I need to make sure that my grift keeps running by keeping their grift running. And that's how we keep this whole thing moving.
It's that once you're on the inside, you always need to be performing a little bit. It's kind of terrifying and it's like asphyxiating. It's like you can never let up for one second, right? Like Carmella can never not portray her life in a certain way and act a certain way and put this image forward, because otherwise it's they have to, like, have this illusion of legitimacy.
And it's the same is true for all the way down, though. It's also true for Instagram influencers.
Exactly.
It's true for everybody. It's like,
because Instagram influencers are they are doing an extortion racket. They are that's mm-hmm. what happens. Like, I get people who email me every day and they go, hey, the game cafe looks so cool. I'd love to come in and do photos of it. And I go, great, come in and take pictures. And they go, what rates do you offer for influencers? So,
Yelp is a protection racket. For
it gives
sure.
people a fucking special business card. If you're an elite Yelp reviewer, they send you business
sticker.
Cards, and you're supposed to hand it to the host stand, and it says, "Hello, I'm an elite Yelp reviewer, mm-hmm. and, like, I'd hate for a bad review to be left on your restaurant, so please give me special service."
Yeah, you got such a nice place here,
and it's understood that the kitchen is supposed to send out treats, and you're supposed to get better service, and so it's. But that's not the place that that occupies in America is not like the some dark recess of the American mind. Like, that's like, it's like normal. It's like fully normalized. Like, we just all are, and that's what I mean of like, it's not like, oh man, the whole system is so fraudulent. No, it's that fraud became mainstream. Everyone's running some fucking grift.
But fraud, but also alongside a certain kind of Trump-esque branding. As long as we're going through the greatest hits, think about Tiger King. Whether you're talking about Joe Exotic or whether you're talking about Jeff, where they're like, that once the shit goes down, they're like, I don't have any fucking money. What are you talking about? That bitch Carol Baskin can sue me all she wants. And you're like, I don't have any money. That's my purse. I don't know you. But no, he's like, I don't have any money. And it's like, and then just like, I don't have any money. And I'm like, wait a minute. Your entire fucking deal up till now is like how incredibly successful you are. And like now you're basically borrowing or stealing money from your mom to keep this thing going. But like once you get caught dead to rights, you go like, yeah, well.
Because he was trapped in his, so a lot of this feeling of grifting too, I think is I don't fully understand this, but there's like, so definitely some people tend to get stuck in it in a certain way, right? Like once you take the VC funding, you're sort of like tying off, and now you just have to you got to shoot up with that VC money for the rest of your company. That there's never, you can never not take it, right? Like you have this, like you need to be growing all the time once you opt into that. Once you're doing some sort of like scam, like once he bought the tigers, he had to feed the old tigers, so he had to have new tigers get made, and then that added to his costs later. He could never get out. Like, he was as trapped as those animals in his fucking zoo.
Well, or like the restaurateur guy in Goodfellas, where he's getting, the guys come in there, they're always eating there, Joe Pesci never pays his bill, and then Paulie's like, oh yeah, we're gonna help you out. But what does that turn into? That turns into liquor comes in the back door, goes out the front door, like that kind of thing. And then what do? You light a match. Oh God, Syracuse is going to kill me. Light a match, burn the joint out, you know, that kind of thing. Well, finally, yeah, then basically now we're back to the giving tree, except now the giving tree is that your restaurant that you love so much is now just basically insurance money for Paulie.
Well, but here's the thing though. This gets into privilege, honestly, because everybody here is sort of seen as, you know, like there's that veil of we are an upper middle class family and we're trying for this legitimacy. But the Sopranos didn't opt in. I mean, at some point, somewhere along the line, someone made the decision to go into organized crime. But this character, Artie, he is constantly trying to fight against that. And he just happened to be born into a family that didn't, you know, they were poor because they weren't a part of this. And he keeps turning down help because he's like, I know that once I accept this, I am in it. And it's, you know, it is something I don't want, because he recognizes that this is a choice and a lifestyle and he's going against the grain. And then there's, what is his name? Father Leahy or some shit. I couldn't.
Oh, the high priest who's always hanging out with Carmella.
And that is a man who has opted in and did not need to. And, you know, he's finally, spoilers, he's finally called out. But who is the most manipulative?
Yeah, he's an eel, you know.
Yeah, other than, you know, Tony's mother is a whole different thing.
Oh my God, I love her so much.
Wow.
That scene with her and Uncle Junior in the car, where Uncle Junior is kind of feeding her, the way that he's given her that side eye is so good. I love that scene. I forgot how much I love Livia. You're using mesquite. It makes the pork taste peculiar. Okay, I got to get this out. So
yeah.
Okay, so there's a thing I remember reading, as it turns out, 15 years ago. Now, I just want to clarify. What I'm about to tell you, I don't 100% buy into this. It's a Stephen Berlin Johnson thing, but I do think he does make an interesting point. It'll be in show notes. So he was really there at the birth of Turns Out back in the day, of course. One of his books, oh my God, what is it called? It's called Everything Bad Is Good For You, the ultimate Turns Out book title.
Oh, I remember
he had a
this.
Piece, but he had a piece in the New York Times in 2005 that I've been thinking about since I read it. And this is what really kind of launched his big, like, you know, cultural pundit stuff. But he's talking about, in this case, watching TV makes you smarter. You know, okay. Mm-hmm, yeah. There'll be other links and notes where you can go and join my incredulity and saying, well, that's a pretty broad statement. But he did say one thing that I am still thinking about 15 years later. And on the occasion of rewatching The Sopranos, I want to mention this because I do think about this a lot. He's talking here about, in particular, Sopranos in 24. This is in 2005. And he says, the explicit violence and the post-9/11 terrorist anxiety are not the only elements of 24 that would have been unthinkable on primetime network television 20 years ago. Alongside the notable change in content lies an equally notable change in form. 44 minutes covers 1 hour. But I love this part. So he says, the episode connects the lives of 21 distinct characters, each with a clearly defined story arc, as the Hollywood jargon has it, a defined personality with motivations and obstacles and specific relationships with other characters. This is the thing I feel like we really got. Yes, there had been Hill Street Blues. Yes, there had been many, many shows. Sopranos is the show that broke open a really big idea, which is that unlike the sitcoms of a previous age or the dramas of a previous age, it was about a family or it was about an office. And there was a main character. There's usually a friend. There's a girl, right? There's this main, but it's really about everybody's relationship with the main characters. And the lower you are, as I say on the call sheet, the less likely you are to have your own arc unless you're the wacky neighbor. The Sopranos, I return to this, and it's just as I remembered, it's about everybody's relationship with everybody, which is such an ambitious idea. The kind of thing Robert Altman would do in the 70s in some ways. It's like, I'm going to give you the messiness of human life. It's not just how Tony gets along with people and how people get along with Tony. It's going to come down to like Christopher and Polly and how they're doing this week in their relationship. And I feel like that just, it's so masterful that they can get through all of these different relationships with people, bringing in Melfi's dumb boyfriend and what that means, that he's seeing Tony doing this and the way the restaurant guy greets Tony this way and says, oh, I haven't seen you in so many months. It's not just the relationships with the main character or the main family. It's everybody's relationship with everybody, and it all has consequences.
That's what I would, that to me, that's world building. Like, The Sopranos was really ambitious in its world building, and it would put these minor little things and these little characters or, you know, things in, and they would have a huge payoff like 3 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that takes assuredness, confidence.
An example is in the run of The Sopranos, there's sometimes where you see fake movies and TV shows that exist in their universe, and they're so good. I mean, they're so well conceived.
Yeah. Yeah. And doesn't, so. So spoiler here, I guess. Remind me, because I only did watch the first episode and some of the second. You know, the what's his name? The guy who's like dying of leukemia. What's his name?
Oh, Uncle the main mob boss guy. I think.
But you know, there's the one guy.
Yeah.
But like, he's the hook is we're introduced to him. He is the current like head of the family, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's dying of leukemia, and that's his hook. But then doesn't he survive it and that kind of fucks things up? Isn't that what happens?
No.
What is it that happens with that guy? I just remember thinking at the time, this is a pretty ambitious way to show disruption in this family. What is it? What is that character's name and what is his deal in episode or in season one?
Well, I think his name is Uncle I don't remember, but he is the acting.
No, it's not Junior.
No, not Junior. Like it's not Junior. It's not like he you barely see him after the first episode, not in a hospital bed. So
Jackie April.
Thank you. When he passes away, the reason that gets fucked up is because it's like, is Tony the next in line or is Junior the next in line?
Junior's saying to Livia, Junior's definitely feeding Livia the intel to say like, you know, I'm the one who can bring the ducks back in some ways. He won't even let me conduct my own business.
Well, and I think also the hitch in this is the true boss of the family is in currently serving time. So that's why there's an acting boss. And they don't exactly, I remember at the time not being confused, but obviously I can't convey exactly how the, you know, like they literally show that, you know, typical police board of the pyramid of how everybody stacks up in terms of power.
Oh, like the crazy wall of the crime family.
Yeah. But that's sort of the main thing where Tony is, spoilers, is like, let's just let Junior have his day. You know, he's mm-hmm. an old guy.
Cause he's got to keep everybody happy enough for now. Mm-hmm. It's the entire story of what he has to do to keep people loyal.
He's a middle manager.
He is, but also it's the loyalty that he craves, that he feels like his father's generation got. He wants that loyalty, but also he's realizing to hold it together, I guess as ever, you've got to keep everybody happy. You've got to keep everybody not rebelling, not looking for a better deal, not looking for the opportunity to get out and end up fucking up your deal. It's, I mean, like the stress that guy must feel, the agita.
I want to go back. Okay, I have one thing. We should probably get to the after show, but I had one thing from that Alex mentioned that I was super interested in, which is,
oh yeah, 90s thing.
Some media ages, you know, it comes out and it ages and you go back and you look at it and you were like, damn, that a good example for me is like I went back a while back and I rewatched the original Iron Man, the first Iron Man from 2008.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like,
that's a very good movie.
Oh, it's great, but it looks old, like in a way that I didn't expect, because the Marvel movies have developed a very contemporary visual language, and then that one is sort of like it's not in the same visual language, and it just, I don't know, it just looks old. Like if you go back and watch it,
the wonderful scenes at the beginning, which it's such a wonderful way to start a movie, but like him, and it's obviously like Iraq era, wouldn't you say? It's not Afghanistan, it's Iraq.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. One of those. Yeah, I don't know that they specify.
And but like, you know, him with his weird comic book character beard and drinking in the car and like, don't put this on your MySpace and all that kind of stuff.
Here, I think I know where Max is going to go with this, but I think Iron Man ages poorly, not just because it's so of a certain time, but the language or the style guide of the MCU hadn't really been written yet. So you go back and watch, like,
sure,
Iron Man 2 and 3 aren't good, but it's...
I picked a bad example because it's in a cinematic universe. I'm just saying, like, as a film, it just looks old. Like, it's not bad. Mm-hmm. It just, you look at it and you're like, yeah, that looks old. Like, I remember when I saw it in theaters and I was like, that's the freshest shit I've ever seen. And it doesn't feel fresh anymore. It feels old.
Well, like we were watching, I made my kid watch a little bit of The Rock last night. We'd watched this documentary about Alcatraz, and there's just something like the woman, Nicolas Cage is so good in The Rock, and his girlfriend or wife in that. Like, I was like, man, she has such great 90s makeup, but she looks so 90s.
I have a perfect example of this. Total Recall. Because I was reminded of it because it's in the Paul Verhoeven podcast that you posted.
Yep.
Total Recall.
No. He puts the gun in his leg. I listened to that podcast 3 times. It's 2 hours long, and I've listened 3 times.
Total Recall. I would say one of my favorite movies. I mean, Paul Verhoeven, one of my favorite directors. I this isn't a knock against the movie, which I think is like a brilliant, brilliant, amazing film. It just looks old. Like, I just rewatched it. I just rewatched it this weekend. And
Sharon Stone's hair is definitely of a time.
It just looks old. Like, all the whole idea of how technology would work is old. Like, it's all just old. It looks like an old movie. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look like a period piece or anything. It just looks old. Now, let me, there's a lot of, most media ages that way. You look back on it and you're like, man, that's old. And if you were around to see it originally come out, then you feel old by extension. But there's something about some media, I don't know what it is, it's just a really good observation, Alex, that when you look at The Sopranos, it doesn't feel old. It feels like it was a period piece, like it was made today, but it was set dressed to feel like the 90s. Yep. What is that? Is that the quality of the writing? I couldn't tell you.
I see what you're saying. Well, like, how is it that, for example, you look at something, it's like a spider web. You don't want to break the effect of it. But like, you look at something like 2001, A Space Odyssey. And for a movie that was made in 1968, it looks shockingly modern in some ways. Yeah, it's dated. Like, I guess you the outfits that people have in it or something. Or again, look at something like Dr. Strangelove, whereas Dr. Strangelove is very much like an early 60s movie, but it also just, it doesn't look old in that same way. How is it that a movie from 1968 let's say, of 2001 could look so much better than Space 1999? Was it just budget? Like, how is it that some things have capture an aesthetic and a feeling that doesn't age, even though you could tell it's an older thing? Kind of?
Well, yeah, I think it's just because The Sopranos is very aware of what is happening, and it's showcasing how life is in the 90s. And you're constantly, not constantly, but you're being reminded of what life was like before for Italian Americans and how people are perceiving people like Tony Soprano at this moment in time. And also, Mario Kart has a somewhat significant place in, I don't know, I just kept being like, yay, look at that. And you see how, I don't know if this is intentional, but you see how psychiatry is perceived this way, and how like people thought of Prozac in the late 90s, like it was this new thing, and it's kind of constantly, I mean,
it was still kind of a punchline.
Yeah exactly. And they're talking about it like, is this, it's a thing I hear, it's fine. And I just think that part of the show, also, you know, this was largely made by one person, and this is, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is one of the first times that, like, there truly was a showrunner, and it was, you know, there was a writer's room, but this is one person going full steam ahead with his vision.
Their taste, it's more than writing and directing, it's the taste and tone. Yes. And the book, the Bible of the show. Like, there's something, there's an imprimatur on this.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of think there's a similar feel to The Godfather that they specifically talk about, where it's like, oh, it was made in the 1970s. Like, no, that's right, but it is about the,
it's about the 40s.
Yeah, and that has the same feel, because it's very aware of its I didn't know as a kid that it was made in the 70s, but it was about the 50s. Like, that, you know, that just kind of goes over your head. And also, it is shot very well. I'm like, is this 16:9? Is my iPad fucked up? Like, and I didn't even look into exactly how it was shot or stuff like that. But I kept thinking, wow, this is like a film. But I think more than how it was mechanically made in terms of filmmaking, it's much more the writing. And they also don't fall into the tropes that a lot of shows do with doing certain things with tech without some sort of explanation. Like, anything that happens with cell phones or beepers, like, we know in the lexicon of crime that's a thing that happens, kind of like in The Wire. There are very few
payphones.
Yeah, they sneak in some, as you know, Bobs in a easy, like it goes down easy, kind of like with Prozac. This very, they don't use it as a punchline, but it's like, yes, it is 1999 and we don't know how we feel about this yet, but it doesn't,
that there's a shot of him, I love this shot, I just lingered on this for a while, where you see Tony out there hitting golf balls. And you're like, where is he? What is that, a municipal golf course? What is that? And then the plane flies over his head. And then we cut to the shot of him, like, taking out the bottle of Prozac. I don't know. There's just something about that. I was like, oh my God, did you know how cool that would look? How much that would place him in New Jersey? You know what I mean? It's,
yes,
like, without having to go like, oh, look, it's, you know, it's this deli that everybody knows or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's just some inherent New Jersey-ness to a heavy mobster in a field hitting balls while a plane flies over his head. And it's like, you located that so beautifully.
Also, the two towers in the opening credits.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh! Too soon!
That's a gabagool.
That's a gabagool. Oif. That's no good, boss.